Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 55, section 5, which is old single column, page 629. All right. So we have a little interlude here. They stepped us through the seven stages of light and light, just merely relative to an individual world. And then as you see here, there's a couple of sections that are a transitional interlude, and then we're going to step through the stages again, but now. In a large scale, where we're literally going to be looking at a whole system, a local system being settled in light and life, and then a whole constellation, etc., stepping all the way through the levels that way. Get a little better sense of what kind of an environment an individual world exists in as it's going through its own individual stages. We couldn't really tell that before. I mean, as we're going through, as the world is stepping through those seven stages, I mean, at some point, there's probably the whole, it's in a constellation that's totally settled in light and life, and at some point, then it's in a whole local universe that's settled in light and life, et cetera, as it's moving, just individually through those stages. So we want to think about that bigger context that each world is in as well. But before we do that, they've got... some additional things I want to toss in here about the nature of things on worlds in light and life. So let's just jump in and we'll.
Was it last week when you were talking about correlating this with God the Sevenfold?
You'll see a little additional piece of that will come up here, but let me just go ahead and tee that up. So they pointed out is that you get started in moving up the levels of the sevenfold, starting in the second stage of light and life on the world. You're working on the first level. So second stage on the first level of God the Sevenfold, and then moving up from there, in each subsequent stage of light and life. You're trying to, acquire, in thinking about what you're doing as you're moving up those levels of the sevenfold, you're trying to take slices of wholeness that you wrap your mind around in an effort to eventually try to genuinely encompass some measure of the total wholeness of that facet of deity that's called the sevenfold. A very complex facet of deity from our perspective in terms of its immediate consequences in terms of reality, just how many individuals, how many individualities exist relative to that one facet of deity, whereas a lot of facets of deity from our perspective seem to be more straightforward because from our perspective, there's just one individual, for instance, that's relative to that. You just have one eternal son. But there's a little bit of a, it's not quite that simple because every creator son has some son-type deity. It's part of their deity nature. So it's not just literally one individual. But initially it appears to be a more straightforward thing to wrap your mind up. But there isn't any sort of initial simple appearance trying to get to the facet of deity called the sevenfold. As soon as you look at it, there's an uncountable number of individuals on the lowest level, right? The number of master physical controllers is beyond our numerical concept. So, I mean, it's so... insanely complicated, even on first blush. Right? So, it not surprisingly, such a complicated challenge is put forward when a world gets enlightened life, and you've got individuals that can meet such a challenge. None of us have the capacity right now to approach such a thing. In any sort of direct physics way, right? Like they're trying to do. Okay. Kind of along that lines, when you look at the title of this section number 5, like I was just saying, you're thinking about what humans can do when they really get to the top of the mountain that is nativity sphere human potential. Just how high a mountain is there to climb on a first world? And you know the answer, basically. A mountain that's taller than anything you can imagine, a metaphoric mountain, that's taller than anything you can even imagine right now. So much higher than anything, Jesus, could even dream of achieving, when he was here in the flesh. And Michael is here as Jesus, in the flesh. Very, very pinnacle, biologic individuals that can have very high phases of mind seated on such an apex biology. Okay, so let's take a look at what they say here.
Section 5, the acme of material development. Mortal creatures living on a sin-stricken, evil-dominated, self-seeking, isolated world such as Urantia can hardly conceive of the physical perfection, the intellectual attainment, and the spiritual development which characterize these advanced epochs of evolution on a sinless sphere.
Okay. So start with that last bit there. They've literally stated it directly, just so we could face that fact. We often imagine a sinless domain. You actually technically get to it. Remember how places in the book they point out that your run-of-the-mill error and evil is plenty adequate as a contrast to stimulate choice. You don't literally need sin and iniquity. But, of course, every world has sin to begin with, and iniquity as well. But you do actually eventually get to a point on a world where there is no more sin. Now, the biologic foundation is so perfected that potential is just technically not there anymore. Theoretically, yes, but it never actualizes. Everyone has a big enough picture just naturally that no one gets off on that self-absorbed tangent anymore. But remember what they said. It doesn't mean you don't have evil. You got to challenge yourself to not think like we've always done about the word evil, right? You still have some brokenness of unity. You still have evil, but you don't have sin. Okay? Just you have to think about it more, in physics terms, right? With this additional energy fact of spirit substance, that you have some brokenness relative to that other energy still. There is evil, but not sin.
So probably none of the 37 worlds of Red into Rebellion were enlightened life then. Probably.
Right, no. All those worlds, remember, they're all worlds that are very close to us in development. Part of this block of 200 worlds that we're in our local system, that are all kind of same ballpark of development. Right? None of the worlds in the previous 200, that are hundreds of millions of years ahead of us, no, they're way enlightened life. And right, it's just, it's only when you're in this very primitive, relatively primitive state like we are, that anyone could go down that, you know, that path. I mean, especially the system. The planetary prince. You know, I mean, I started to say system sovereign because I was thinking S. I was thinking planetary sovereign, and I got my S's flipped up in my head. But you know, if I was going to make that point, I mean, you know, let alone the planetary prince, who in enlightened life is the planetary sovereign. I mean, the only way that a planetary prince can become a planetary sovereign is when there is absolutely no possibility for that prince to go astray. You're not going to give anyone in the universe sovereignty when they can go astray.
System sovereign went
astray. Right. Right. But...
I don't
want to
get off on that, I'm sorry.
Right, it's important that you brought that up because I was just about to tack on a little thing about that, that you're not going to let anyone who has as, you know, sort of intimate a relationship with the ascending mortals, with the vulnerable children, that chance to go to iniquity like that. You know, there's a buffer between the planetary, the system sovereign, and ascending mortals. Even when you're, you know, we talked a lot when we were thinking about the mansion worlds. It's like, you know, imagine if you were on the mansion worlds, you know, during the rebellion, you know, you'd have to face these sophistries coming directly from, say, Satan and whatnot. Yeah, but you have a Maharaja mind. Okay, and you've got all kinds of helpers. You're not as vulnerable. I mean, the only exception is the probationary nursery. You know, and that's why they make such a big deal out of that. You know, and you know, you can imagine that. You know, when you read between the lines of that, that you know, there was a quick mobilization to try to buffer those sort of helpless little children, you know, from that pernicious influence. But on a nativity sphere, you have these just basically helpless material creatures like us, you know, in a very rudimentary state of development. You know, they are so vulnerable.
So when the whole system was put into quarantine, the planets that were in light and life in the system were probably aware of the fact that it got put into quarantine at that point.
I'm just trying to think about that. You know, if you give... You know, sovereignty is a definitive fact. I mean, you know, when they say sovereign, they mean sovereign. They mean that individual, you know, can do things without anyone having the potential to question their actions. Right? See, and that's, you know, so that's what, you know, what you got to think about. All right. Let's see. That's just that one little issue, and it took us that long to deal with that. Let's get to the real meat of that paragraph. Okay, so mortal creatures living on a sin-stricken, evil-dominated, self-seeking, isolated world such as Urantia. I mean, the thing that you want to really let sink in there, I mean... You know, it's sin-stricken. You know it. There's lots of self-seeking individuals. But evil-dominated, you might not have been willing to go that far yet. It's like, well, what about, overcoming evil with goodness, and there's all this goodness, and yeah. But it's still evil-dominated. That's a very strong thing for them to say. Right? So, I mean, but remember, don't overplay that. You know, when you hear from your evolutionary background, evil dominated, you think iniquity dominated is what you're technically thinking. Right? No, not even, it's not sin dominated even. Okay, but it is evil dominated. That doesn't mean the black ooze is dominant over God, right? Because there is no black ooze, right? Don't think about it in the old-fashioned terms. Don't put new wine in old wineskins. Right, it just means that that the majority, at least, state of affairs on the planet is broken relative to the unity substance. Right? There, you don't have dominantly a unity fact in place here. It's dominantly individuated. Okay. I mean, you got to think about the word evil in that more technical term. That, you know, and of course, you know, and an evil is not even, you know, immediately the outer life, an outer life fact. It's an inner life fact. It's giving badness form in your mind. That's evil, right? But so, but in the individual minds on this world, there is no balance between unity and individuality. The unity is basically broken in that mind. So all you have is the by nature individuality, untempered by unity, right? And so if that's the case, it's an automatic consequence that it's self-seeking, right? In the same way that a little child, pre-age six, can't be anything but self-seeking. There's no unity to be even potentially balance the individuality. They're just nothing but that individuality. The first word is me, mine, right? I mean, that's the way we all start, right? And, you know, so everyone is, you know, is dominated by individuality like that. But you wouldn't describe that two-year-old as evil-dominated because there's no spirit there that has gotten broken, right? They're pre-spirit, individual, right? Until roughly age six, all right? So you don't describe that as evil, but you know, when once they're post six, and you know, and you see something where you see no tempering of that individuality by unity, right? That's, you know, they're beginning now more and more to be appropriately described as a more and more broken, disrupted, technically evil phenomenon. Okay. And it doesn't have to be any desire to be evil at all, right? To be evil. At that, you know, you got to keep sin and evil separated, right? So when they say evil dominated, they don't mean desire for badness dominated.
Yeah, it just is. Yeah. They actually think they're doing good.
Right. Yeah. Right. Most likely, you know, especially in recent decades, you know, it's, yeah, that would be your first assumption, is they very definitively, from their perspective, they think, you know, they're doing good, which they're not, right? Because they don't have a big picture. You know, it might seem like unity in that tiny little circumscribed space that they're assessing things in, but if you expand the picture, you see it's a shattered piece of glass, right? It's very much broken, but they don't see it that way. They've got their eyeball on one little shard, and it looks like unity to them. Right? Right, but it's actually broken, and they don't recognize that. So it is evil, even though, right, there's no desire for that or any awareness of that.
Well, with evil dominated, the term ignorant came to mind.
Right.
But my problem is, spirit dominates mind. And how? But it seems like mind is instrumental in repairing, or I shouldn't say repairing, but in establishing.
Right, right, but spirit dominates mind. But remember, you have control of whether or not that spirit over control of mind is positive or negative. Is it an influence that unifies or disrupts the mind? Right, you can use spirit substance to either disrupt your mind and make it evil, or to unify it and make it good. Spirit is not innately divine in terms of its influence on you. That's in your free will hands. You know, you bring unity into play, but in which way? Right? And if there's actually evil, someone has brought unity, dominant over mind, into play, but in a negative way. They've disrupted their mind with spirit, not further unified their mind with spirit. See, and again, like I've stressed so many times, everyone thinks that's impossible, that any spirit brought into relationship to mind innately unifies that mind. No, that's the third principle of the Lucifer Manifesto. That's what Caligaster tried to teach us, that you don't have to figure out if you're imposing a positive or a negative influence. All influences are positive by definition. No. Right? If that was the case, you wouldn't have free will. That's the whole point of free will. It's free. You're free to either, you know, creatively unify your mind or destroy your mind.
Thank God for mercy. You can't tell the difference.
Right. Mercy is there because evil, you know, is just going to be so natural in your initial ignorant state. Right? There obviously has to be mercy. Okay. Sin, okay, is when you start to directly reject that potential, mercy potential, right?
Bankrupt.
Okay. All right, and then just the other, see, it's a tiny little paragraph, but just note everything there. See, like I keep stressing, we can hardly conceive, okay? Don't just think spiritually. Like, well, I probably can't conceive spiritual stuff because I've never kicked spirit substance. I don't really know anything about it, so it's probably beyond my conception. Sure, yes, but all three. You can hardly conceive even the physical perfection, let alone the intellectual attainment or the spiritual development. Okay, and remember what you mean by spiritual development. Nothing that any human has ever thought. Not what you think when you hear spiritual development. It means you have a more developed, literal, direct relationship to that other substance in the external world, right? You know, in the same way that you talk about material development, right? There's really no fundamental difference between material development and spiritual development. There are two substances in the external world. How definitively, precisely, extensively have you brought your mind into relationship with those facts in the external world? Right? So when they talk about spiritual development, there's all of these unrecognized spirit energy systems in our environment. We're immersed in them. We're oblivious to that fact now. But they're just as literally there as this table is in this room. Right? And I can bring myself into conformity with that table. Like, for instance, if I get up, I don't run headlong into it and jam my shin into it. Right, I bring it into my mind into conformity with the existence of that fact in the external world. Same way with the literal spirit substance in the external world. You're getting yourself synchronized and conformal with those spirit ministries. See, you can't even begin spiritual development until you recognize that spirit is something outside of your mind. As long as you think it's something inside your mind, I mean, the only place you can go is down the Lucifer rebellion path,
well, right? In your mind is your thought adjuster, but that's,
right, but
that's different.
But it's not you, right?
Yet.
Yeah, and technically, as a spirit fragment, it's above your mind. It's a deity fragment that it actually can be done within your mind, right? All these details, right? It's just so important to stay humble about spirit, and remember, that. Currently, everyone thinks that spirit is fancy mind, right? And so when they hear spiritual development, they hear, oh, I want to get more of that fancy mind stuff happening. That's not what we're talking about, right? It's getting into relationship, conformity with stuff that's in the external world, okay? And you'll see how they start to, they'll bring that up in a little bit, just how literally they're talking about that. Very, it's just, no one has ever tried to think about it like that. But eventually, you come to recognize, the reason that there hasn't been a tendency to think this way, remember, is because people don't properly think about how your mind or self is related to your experiences. We very much think that we are experiencing that that material fact in the external world. And it's like, well, there's an inside and an outside. So the matter is outside, and I believe in spirit, so that's got to be inside. Well, step one is recognizing you don't actually see that object in the external world. You see a representation of that object that's in your mind. You don't actually see things in the external world. All you can relate to is the representations of spirit or matter in the external world as they are represented in your mind.
Even when you hit your knee on it?
Even when you hit your knee on it, you're not actually feeling the external object. You're feeling a form in your mind. Right, you know, and the revelators, you know, if you might remember, if you're familiar with the book, there's spots where they try to remind you that humans figured that out philosophically a long time ago. Right, you don't have access directly to the external world. All you have access to is the representations in your mind. Okay. If you didn't have any nerves feeding things to your brain, and then the mysterious way that it somehow gets from brain to mind, right? You know, you could bang your knee on that table all day long and you wouldn't feel anything. Right? You don't feel the external object. Right? You feel the representation in your mind. And so, you know, once that sinks in, then, you know, it's like, okay, there's another substance out there. You know, and a spiritual experience is an experience with a representation of spirit substance in your mind. Just like a material experience is an experience with a representation of a material fact in your mind. You know, and how well developed is that? How well can your mind represent that substance in the external world? If you're colorblind, how well does it represent material objects? Yeah, not so well. Yeah, just think about how probably you know, simplistically and cloudy the current representations of spirit substance are in your mind. Right? I mean, if we can easily see that we've got some fuzziness just with matter and we're material identities.
Almost have to have faith to know it's there.
Right. I mean, they have to be just told that it's there because it's never going, you know, it's never going to appear to be there, right? I didn't know, no human has ever thought that because it took the revelation to just tell me, there's another substance in the external world. Oh, you're kidding me. That's what that word spirit is about. No wonder we haven't been able to figure it out.
We can gauge our ignorance by what they had to tell us.
Right. So, you know, it's like, wow. So how can I get a more precise relationship to something that isn't part of any direct appearance? Like I said, I can't kick it yet.
Is Marantia even another substance in the middle?
Yeah, Marantia is another substance in the hybrid substance in the middle, right? You know, but you know, having a Marantia mind allows you to start to directly see spirit substance in the external world, right? Right now, not so much. Right? I can squint all I want. I'm not going to suddenly see some spirit object, you know, in this room.
Right?
Now,
these worlds, highly advanced in light and life, they can't see the spirit substance directly either.
Let me just hold off. You'll see they touch on that a little bit. We'll start to talk about, you know, those issues. Okay. Okay. I think we must be ready to go on to the next paragraph. It only took us half an hour to do this. Yeah. Oh, you got something too?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mind, you can begin to directly experience spiritual substance in the external world.
Yeah.
So what's the difference between that and having a material, more or less material mind and not being able to experience material substance in the external world?
Wait, no, I mean, not being able to...
I mean, when you have a... You're saying when you have a Marantia mind...
When I have a Marantia mind...
More of a direct experience.
Visualization, of spirit substance, yeah.
Representation.
Right, I mean, it's still a representation, but, you know, I mean, you know, in the same way that I see that table, you know, you can begin to see the spirit substance.
Right? Doesn't mean the table's not real.
But it's not direct access.
No, you never have direct access. You never will. Even a finaliter doesn't have direct access to reality. Only appearance. That's all you have. A divine counselor doesn't have direct access to reality. They only have access to the appearances of the representations in their mind. If you have direct access to reality, you're a creator being. Right. Right? That's how delusional it is to think that you have direct access. Like, if you think you have a direct access to spirit substance, that's how delusional you are. I mean, it's just a hop, skip, and a jump to believing you're God then. You know, you aren't thinking that way, but see, technically that's what you're doing. You know, you're assuming you can go transcend appearance and directly access reality. No, you're not a creator being.
Takes me back to my LSD
days. Okay.
Who decided that? Who said that?
Okay. It's just again, remember, this is the divine revelation in your lap is half of what you're supposed to have in your head as we're reading. The other half is the fruits of the first 2,500 years of evolutionary philosophy, so that you know those things that we began to forget at the beginning of the 20th century, right? You know, you've got to have that logical, objective picture, the cream of those 2,500 years, not the confusion of those 2,500 years, but the cream, truth of those 2,500 years has to be there so that you aren't, you know, misinterpreting everything you're reading here. The plain man can't properly interpret the fifth ethical revelation. Right? Only a reflective thinker can. Right? Otherwise, you'll be putting new wine in old wineskins. Yep.
Yeah, Winston's wondering, well, how does our personality improve all this?
What did he say? Your personality is the means for you to begin to bring all of this confusion into sharper focus. Your personality is a harmonizing influence. It's directly the influence that can begin to get a hold of the triunity of universal reality. And it's only in the triunity that any one of the three is in sharper focus, matter, mind, or spirit. And if you want to truly get spirit into focus, you have to do it in the context of the threefold. Right? It can never be brought into any significant focus just in and of itself. Right? And to appreciate the same way with matter. You know, see, and that's why when they talk about physical perfection, intellectual attainment, and spiritual development, you can get physical perfection in place that we can't even imagine right now, because the physical world will be in sharper focus than we can even imagine it being right now. We'll have it so definitively, you know, our mind will be so definitively wrapped around it and understanding it that you can work with it in ways that just completely are beyond our imagination right now. See? Because you'll be working with it in that triune context. Remember, that was the job of the Trinity Teacher Sons, to really get that triune picture in play. You got the three parts, you got matter, mind, and spirit, and then they come to try to get you to see them anew in the holistic context. And then during Light and Life, you're working on the fruits of that, working with all three of them anew.
Essentially a creative world that they're living in.
Yeah, it becomes more and more of a creative world. And so all of those absolutely unique personalities are beginning to manifest. You know, and since we hardly even know the manifestation of personality yet, let alone the superadditive consequence of a whole world full of personalities, mm-hmm. and all their creativity, right? It's just completely beyond our imagination what's going on. Okay.
The advanced stages of a world settled in light and life represent the acme of evolutionary material development. On these cultured worlds, gone are the idleness and friction of the earlier primitive ages. Poverty and social inequality have all but vanished. Degeneracy has disappeared, and delinquency is rarely observed. Insanity has practically ceased to exist, and feeble-mindedness is a rarity.
Okay, remember we touched on this a little bit, you know, so they're coming back to that. And you know, remember how in the first stage of the light and life they were pointing out, you know, you still had a number of these things in play in a non-negligible way. But like they're saying, the advanced stages of a world settled in light and life, you know, things are getting much more buttoned down. Okay, notice the definitive one. Degeneracy has disappeared. So the fundamental vertical biologic, you know, genetic issue is totally gone. There is no below to the biology, biologic expression on the planet. Everyone is up at, you know, at the peak of biologic nature. So there's no issues that are fundamentally of a vertical, predicated on that verticalness anymore. There is a little bit of horizontal. See, that's the other things that they're saying there. You still see poverty and social inequality have all but vanished, but it doesn't say vanished, all but. Remember, in both of those, both poverty and social inequality are fundamentally genetic. Right? And so if you eliminate all the vertical genetic issue and almost all of the horizontal, but you know, there's always, you know, a little bit of horizontal spectrum. Right? There's always a little bit of a bell curve horizontally. And that never goes away. So, you know, there's going to be a little bit of a lesser tail horizontally. So, but it'll be all but vanished. And delinquency is rarely observed. Same reason. You know, so, you know, and think about what that means literally. You know, you basically have no antisocial expressions. And almost zero defiance of law. Everyone is automatically law-abiding. Well, you think, wow, if that's the case, you can probably start to actually get rid of all of that external law stuff. Right. And you'll see, you know, they mention that. But see, you know, so delinquency, you know, everyone's law-abiding, you know, and socially conformative. Yep.
How are they utilizing degeneracy? What are they referring to?
Roman Catholic. No, that's what I said. I mean, that's why I said what I said. Degeneracy means a vertical problem genetically, right? That you are literally inferior. You're below what you should be genetically. It's not that you're off to the side, just kind of a curious off to the side expression of fundamentally appropriate genetics. You know, you're just literally inferior genetically. Okay? That's all gone. All right, you've completely eliminated. You've got physical perfection, right? See, you know, look at the word they used there, physical perfection, not perfectingness. They said perfection, right? So yeah, shouldn't be surprised that the verticalness is gone.
How would there be any feeble-mindedness?
Well, again, see, almost all of it's going to be gone because there's nothing of the vertical nature anymore. But insanity has practically ceased to exist, and feeble-mindedness is a rarity. Again, there's going to be a little bit that's caused just because of, you know, you're way off in the tail horizontally in the genetic expression. Okay. Remember how they told you that, you know, inescapably you've got old age issues still, right? I mean, you can't, you know, there's nothing you can do scientifically to change the fact that when you age, you fall apart. Okay. That's just the way it is. But obviously it's going to be dealt with, you know, in a very amazing way, so it's very minimal how much it's going to impact. But obviously they're not talking about the old age thing here. They're just talking about fundamentally, you know, when you're, you know, at a relatively young age, you know, you don't have insanity and feeble-mindedness. Okay. Yeah. Basically.
In medicine, there's a term, something morbidity. I can't think of the word, but what it essentially means that a healthy individual ages and gets old, but they stay relatively healthy up until the time just before they pass away, and then they have a rapid decline and they pass away.
Right. They aren't morbid. They aren't fundamentally diseased.
No.
Right. You know, of body or mind. Right. When they, you know, when the life animation is still fully engaged to the matter. Right. And yes, when life animation starts to break away from the matter, the second law of thermodynamics begins to unravel the matter. That's, you know, that's just the way it is. But yeah, and the adjutants can, you know, can't seat themselves as well, and et cetera, et cetera. Yes. Okay. Anyway, so just yeah, so everything has been eliminated except what you can't eliminate. Right? You can't make it so there isn't some measure of a bell curve horizontally. But you can eliminate any sort of a literal lowering of the fundamental biologic level that the human is being expressed on. Everyone is expressing on the peak level eventually.
And I wonder what they mean by feeble-minded.
Yeah, right. See, and again,
probably includes all of us.
Right. I mean, what would be called feeble-minded, it would be so much better than anything any of us can imagine. Right.
Right.
See, again, remember, it's all relative. Right. Our best mind that's ever lived would be called horrendously feeble-minded, if not insane to them. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Again, like I said, I mean, don't look to, you know, it's like, oh, everyone will be like Jesus. No. They'll be so much better than Jesus that, it, you know, we can't even imagine it.
Jesus is a man.
Right. Jesus was a man that lived 2,000 years ago
on this world,
on this world, you know, that is sin-stricken, evil-dominated, self-seeking. I mean, we all know how many biologic, you know, genetic issues Jesus struggled with. You know, he had some tendencies from his mom that were problematic, etc. I mean, he's primitive relative to the people we're talking about here. None of them have any of those kinds of issues, right? They would never go, oops, oh, wait a minute, I'm letting it get away from me. That never happens with these people. They're all rock solid, right? yeah. Okay. All right, let's keep going here.
The economic, social, and administrative status of these worlds is of a high and perfected order. Science, art, and industry flourish, and society is a smoothly working mechanism of high material, intellectual, and cultural achievement. Industry has been largely diverted to serving the higher aims of such a superb civilization. The economic life of such a world has become ethical.
Okay, so, you know, it's obvious why they throw in that. They want to, you know, remind you that, you know, our imagination about, you know, a utopian world, right, is not totally off in la-la land, even though we can't think, you know, directly, literally about, you know, the science there or the art there or anything like that. The spirit of our thoughts is valid, right? You know, all the things that we yearn to melt away, you know, unethical, you know, businesses or whatnot, right? I mean, all that is obviously way in the rearview mirror. But it's that way because the individuals are just so innately integrous, right? They have such a recognition of the big picture that it's almost impossible for any of them to think that something is better for them when it really isn't, right? They immediately can calculate. It's like, well, okay, if I do this and then I extrapolate that into the next million people for the next 1,000 years, oh, that won't be good. So I'm not going to do that because that wraps back around and is not good for me. I mean, you know, it's impossible for them to ever think that somehow this is better when it really isn't, right? Because they have such a sense of the big picture. That it's that fundamental, top-down, philosophic, big picture vantage point that is what produces all this. I mean, everyone has that.
Can you imagine
this? Right, and that if two people had that on this planet, the interplay between those two people, what that would have produced?
Yeah.
You know, what if you have millions like that? What would that produce?
You need welding glasses.
that the super additive consequence is incomprehensible. Yeah. What would happen? Right? You know, we can kind of imagine, what would it be like? Imagine if we all worked together. Like, for instance, if we weren't absolutely certain that our side of some dichotomy was absolute. You know, imagine if we actually worked together as humans instead of programs on one side of a dichotomy or another, right? You don't need a human to vote for a person with a particular letter after their name. You can have a computer check that box, right? Just think about that. Anyone who votes for just whatever letter is after someone's name is not a human. That's a machine. Optical character recognition can recognize the D or the R and check the box. That's a fancy animal voting, not a human. You know? Yeah, but we love to think that, oh, no, it's because I endow that with some transcendent belief that it is human. No, it's not. That's delusion. I can teach a machine to do that. Until someone can't predict which box you're going to check, you're not human. If it's predictable which box you're going to check, you're not functioning as a human. Remember what they say about personality. That can't be predicted in advance. Mind, no matter how fancy, you can calculate that. The extent to which you're just voting as a mindless self, that was all part of the simulation that the adjuster was in on DeVinnington. The adjuster knew every vote you were going to make throughout your whole life. And whether you would vote or not, yes. That was all predictable, right? Most likely. Right?
So the adjuster's the U minus personality. Just the U minus personality.
Right. I mean, the adjuster, remember, is just trying to figure out how to work with that mindal self. Right? And really, it doesn't have to concern itself too much with the variations that personality might bring to that mind, because there's almost no personality that's going to be going on,
yeah.
Right? It's basically just going to grind out the laws of mind energy in that environment. Like I said, they're simulating the whole environment, the whole planet. Everything and every being on the planet is in the simulation. Every grain of sand, every insect, it's all in the simulation, and they just run it, right? They know where every mosquito is going to be at every point in time, and, you know, and we say that's impossible. Well, remember, you can go to the local universe headquarters world and dial up a particular single-celled animal on a particular world and read off the meter that the measure of the quantity and the quality that single-celled animal is using on that world. I mean, and that's just Salvington. That's just the life carriers on Salvington. Think about how much more sophisticated it is on DeVinnington. Yeah. I mean, we have to wrap our minds around this. I mean, even though it's just completely beyond our imagination, you've got to take this into account. It's child's play for them to put the number of atoms on this planet into a simulator. That's trivial. Okay? We're getting to the point in science now where we should have some sense of this. I mean, we're already starting to believe that if we could just make our computer programs, and computers a little bit more sophisticated, we might actually be able to pretty definitively simulate, say, the Earth's atmospheric system. You got to bring in the oceans and the actual material Earth, in the play some too. But we're starting to believe that maybe with not too distant future, we could adequately simulate, the Earth's system. Okay, I mean, DeVinnington. We're talking DeVinnington. I mean, this is triviality, right? They can literally just put every mindal self and every you know, thing in being, you know, in the simulator and just run it. They know how many steps you're going to take on Tuesday, and right, I mean, it's all there. So the adjuster can just live through that. You know, and they can run it in fast time. So in a very short span of time, the adjuster just goes through your whole life. Guy has all the basics. You know, who you're going to marry, how many times you're going to marry, etc. It all mostly just plays out. No matter how much we think that it's like, oh no, that's only because of a whole bunch of random things that happened. It's like, no. Is there anything random even in supremacy? Yeah. Let alone on Divinington, where you're assessing it completely transcendent of supremacy? It's just, we have to think about how well they know us in advance. And your challenge is to not be predictable. To do something that's not predictable on Divinington, that wasn't in the adjuster's simulation. Let's see if you can do that.
Especially in our
see if you can actually exercise free will. Right?
Well, as long as it's not in rebellion.
Yeah, and there's the trick, see? That if you actually achieve genuine free will, now it's a double-edged sword. Right? Whoops. Now you could really sin instead of just think you sin when really all you did is transgress a taboo. Right? Right. Most people don't sin because they aren't personal enough to sin. Right? Fancy animals can't sin. You got to get up to actually use your personality to genuinely sin, deliberately disloyal to deity.
So when the adjuster, you brought this up, I got to ask this question.
Yeah.
So when the adjusters are, you know, looking, doing this ahead of time on Divinity before you're born looking, do they also take into consideration in your... what's going on in other people's lives that are reflecting your...
Yeah, so I try to make that point. I mean, everyone is in the system.
Do you think they, Jesus' adjuster, knew that Joseph was going to get killed, you know, when he was 14 years old, or the accident of time, whatever, which then made him have to be a father and experience that whole thing and so on and so forth, which, you know, I mean, it seems tragic, but in the end was probably...
Yeah, see, I mean...
Probably did.
The degree to which, you know... You know, there's a little bit that's actually personal on the planet. You know, we don't want to overplay it, but you know, an awful lot of it is totally calculable in advance. And so, but you know, little Jesus didn't have access to the adjusters, you know, foreknowledge. You know, and again, it's not foreknowledge in our magical sense. We think someone jumps forward in time and looks. No. You just extrapolate forward, right? I don't have to jump forward in time to know where Mars is going to be in December. I just run the calculation forward and I know where it's going to be. I mean, you just extrapolate.
Right?
The degree to which this world can be extrapolated is the degree to which, you know, it's known in advance what's going to happen.
So if I could do that with the stock market, I'd be a good
consumer. Yeah. Right. The randomness of the stock market, you know, in a complicated enough simulation is completely predictable.
Interesting.
Right. Especially because everyone knows, you know, there's very little personality behind the fluctuating of the stock market. Most of that is just mind ourselves, you know, just responding in very predictable ways. That's why there's patterns, you know, that you can recognize eventually and stuff. It's because it's, you know, it's not really non-predictable personal behavior. It's mechanical, right? Or, you know, like why does traffic set up standing waves? You know, half an hour after the accident has been cleared and everything, you still have to wait at a dead stop on a highway, and you finally inch your way up, and it's like, well, there's no accident here, you know, and instantly you can drive at full speed again. You know, that standing wave just stands there. That's because we're basically like particles, you know, or like water molecules.
No matter how much we get on the horn.
I mean, it's like there isn't even any mind there, right? I mean, matter itself can set up a standing wave like that, and we just, you know, it takes us so long to overcome the material inertia and actually begin to transcend that and smooth that out again. I mean, this just shows you how limited we're expressing, right? Yeah, all right. Let's see, where were we? I can't even
remember.
So we ended on the ethical? Yeah, okay. Yeah, so we got everything there, I think. Just a one little between the lines, you know, you ought to be curious. Industry has been largely diverted to serve the higher aims of such a superb civilization. We'll come back to that. You know, how much higher definition the word industry has. Okay.
War has become a matter of history, and there are no more armies or police forces. Government is gradually disappearing. Self-control is slowly rendering laws of human enactment obsolete. The extent of civil government and statutory regulation in an intermediate stage of advancing civilization is in inverse proportion to the morality and spirituality of the citizenship.
Right, so they're just, you know, you see the basic thing they're wanting you to think about is what they were hinting at before. Getting to the point where the law is written in your heart. And by heart, we mean the upper domain of the hourglass analogy, right? You're so conformal to the cosmos that your conformity to this cosmic civilization is just automatic. You know, self-control is slowly rendering laws of human enactment obsolete. Right? And that's our job. Really, our only job in this life to begin that process, to be humans that need less external law, to take more direct control of your mind or self rather than having to be controlled by something external. Control, 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 more and more self-control. And that begins with a recognition of a personal responsibility. There's no way you're going to control yourself to these high degrees if you don't have a very vast recognition of just how much responsibility is in your hands, in your free will hands. You know, once you sober up and recognize that the awesome responsibility you have to the cosmos, right, you begin to get that incessantly clamoring self under control.
Does that mean I still don't go 60 and a 55?
Yeah, I mean, like we just read, delinquency is almost non-existent. No one says, well, that's just a suggestion. Right? Laws,
guideline.
You know, it's just a guideline. I mean, everyone, if the sign says 55, then that's what you drive. And, you know, there's none of that, you're not the boss of me. You know, none of that sort of rebellious stuff that Kalagastya taught us. Okay. But like I said, I mean, obviously some of these things seem pretty arbitrary, but it all begins, I mean...
It's the spirit of it.
If you're going to obey something significant, you got to start with something small. Right? You know, you need to ask yourself, why do I think I have the right to drive at a different speed than the sign says? Who do I think I am?
Because everybody else is.
Right?
And I'm screwed right? up if
yeah.
I'm too slow.
Yeah, do you use that? That's the excuse that most people say. It's like, well, everyone else is doing it. Oh, so you justify bad behavior by pointing to other bad behavior. It's like, well, how advanced is that thought? Right. Right. Now there is the issue of some pragmatism where you'll actually become it'll be a problem if you're going too slow, if everyone is going, you know, you have to go faster. You know, so, you know, you have to kind of go with the flow of the culture you're in, yes, right? You don't want to think in absolutist terms about this. But you get my point, right? I mean, it's just, you know, it's one thing to be kind of going with the flow like that because it would be dangerous not to, you know, not just for you, but for everyone else. Now that's a pretty objective recognition, but you know it's just you know a lot of people aren't going fast because they have some objective thought in mind like that. Well, for the greater good, I need to not be a nuisance by going too slow, right? It's, who cares about anyone else? I'm going to go whatever damn speed I want to go, right? I mean that's what the thoughts that's in their head. Right? Okay, anyway. All right, so, and again, just notice how they mention morality and spirituality. You know, it should just remind you, the levels of meaning, this whole bit of beginning to conform to spirit substance in the external world. Right? The interface is the sixth level of meaning, the spiritual level. It's not the spirit level, it's the spiritual level. Right? It's not spirit, it's spirit-like, because spirit is actually above the mind. But that top level, butting up against the ceiling, right? You know, that's where the spirit and the external world can come in. And then the next notch down is the moral level, where you're going to begin to bring that unity into an associative expression relative to your individuality. You know, so they keep mentioning that, you know, this sort of bringing things in from the top down, spirit into mind. How much you are conforming to the cosmos, the more you're conforming, the less you're going to need these external regulations imposed upon you. Like I said, inversely proportional.
Yeah, well, yeah. That speaks directly to us today, because these regulations come with a cost to society as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have people rioting, immediate thought, well, they have to get more law enforcement to deal with these rioters.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an increased cost to society when you have people out of control.
Yeah, and that's how it frequently we say, well, the fundamental problem here is these individuals aren't adequately recognizing their individual personal responsibility and exercising internal self-control, mm-hmm. right? In other words, they're not functioning as humans. You know, and the degree to which you're not functioning as a human, you have to be controlled externally, because there's no internal control possible of an animal. Right? Has to be imposed upon you externally. That's right. It's like if you don't want to be treated like an animal, then you need to choose to function as a human. Right? Because society has a right to corral you if you will not self-regulate. Yeah. We don't have to submit ourselves to anarchy, you know, for the sake of your free will. Right? Your supposed free will.
I was just going to say, with regard to Mindel character and teeing off of Shane's thoughts about the directness part, I mean, we can coordinate cosmically without ever being direct in reality for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
Because you get a being that you wouldn't have that way, for one thing.
Right.
And so it's never going to be part of our destiny to have a direct relationship with reality. It'll always be a coordination through a sensory portal,
right.
Really advanced eventually, but still.
Right. You're taking it all the way around and recognizing that clutch between you and reality is important. Because if there was no, differential there, then free will would be impossible. You would just be a helpless victim, you know, of the laws of the energy in the external world.
Right.
Right? The only way to be able to have a domain where free will can manifest is if you aren't rigidly bound to the external world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Start thinking deity.
Yeah. Right. You got to get into the physics of that interface. The interface is via deity, so it's, yeah. Okay. It's not direct.
What was the question again?
For those in the webinar, he was just asking, it's like, well, how does God have free will then? You know, how does a creator being that does have this direct access to reality? They have direct access to it, but they're not rigidly bound to it. Yeah. Yeah. All right, so we've got to there. Okay, yeah, so we're ready to go on here. Yeah.
Schools are vastly improved and are devoted to the training of mind and the expansion of soul. The art centers are exquisite and the musical organizations superb. The temples of worship with their associated schools of philosophy and experiential religion are creations of beauty and grandeur. The open-air arenas of worship assembly are equally sublime in the simplicity of their artistic appointment.
Okay, so here we're going. They're reminding us of what the overall context is for discussions about industry and economic life and all, you know, science and all these things they were mentioning before. So schools are vastly improved and are devoted to the training of mind. Right, this whole bit of consecrating your mind to the universal harmony. And of course, the more you get that mind in conformity to the cosmos, the more your soul is grown. Right? The adjuster reflects that in your soul, you know, the expansion of the soul. Soul gets bigger. And so that's, they were just reminding you have that motive. It's like, why am I working so hard to, you know, improve my mindal conformity to the cosmos? Because I'd like my soul to be grown. Right? That's the me that's going on after this life. I'd like to not start from scratch on the, you know, first mansion world. All right, so, you know, all these things, you know, just superlatives, all they can give us because it's really technically beyond our imagination. But notice that the temples of worship with their associated schools of philosophy and experiential wisdom. All right, so you have the religion as personal spiritual experience. You're definitely fostering a mind that can have a more definitive interaction at that upper boundary with spirit substance in the external world. So there can be more genuine spiritual experiences in your mindal self. But the fundamental thing that's in play, this whole bit about training the mind, I mean, it's schools of philosophy. And the whole point is to have this definitive big picture, top-down big picture worldview. You know, everything else is just details in that context. And no one has anything if they don't first have that philosophic framework, that very definitive, top-down, vast, holistic framework. And to the immediate point of worship, right? Remember how it works on the Isle of Paradise. Who teaches you to worship? The masters of philosophy. They teach you how to worship. The conductors of worship just conduct that worship, but they can't conduct something you don't possess. They don't teach you how to worship. They just conduct the worship that you've been taught. Right? It's masters of philosophy that teach you how to worship, because worship is what? Does anyone remember that advanced thought from that you get, you know, in the Revelation? To philosophize, thinking the truth. Right? You know, if you can think the full dynamic quality of wholeness, that if you can think that, that puts you in full synchrony with the universal harmony. That synchronization is worship. Remember, adoration is something you do upon that foundation. You know, you do an addition to super thinking, to just worship, right?
Do you think this book helps that for us at our level?
That they're trying to get you to have that potential by, by encouraging you to really look up for worship. We have too much of a tendency to look horizontally for the fact of worship. We need to work on looking up beyond what we're currently aware of. Seek it upward. You know, it's like, well, how do I do that? They tell you, well, you've been genetically programmed to pray. Prayer is not an end in itself. It's a means to an end. It's the ladder that you climb to get up to worship. The whole point of having prayer is not to dwell there forever. Oh, I found prayer. Let us build a tabernacle and dwell here forever. That's what current religion thinks. No, it's not an end in itself. It's a means to an end. You want to move up through prayer, eventually transcend prayer into thanksgiving, and then through thanksgiving get to worship. all the way up, way beyond anything you ever imagined, is the fact of worship, super thinking, it's called in the book.
Is there any awe in worship?
Yes, there is. I mean, when you actually feel a synchrony with the whole, right? Right, the awesomeness of all the doors and windows melting away and you feeling the fullness of the whole, yes, right? That's going to flow back and you're going to be very emotional. Right? But, it starts as transcendent of emotion as you can imagine. Actually synchronizing with the whole. Not just feeling some spirit, but the whole. Right. And that's worship. But it's an active thing. It's not a passive thing. Like the revelers say, it's super thinking. Right? And it's not more and more higher and higher thinking of the facts, which is what you think of when you say thinking. No, it's transcendent of thinking any facts. It's thinking the truth. Truth is transcendent of fact. You've got to get above fact. You're still thinking fact when you're praying. You got to transcend prayer, thinking of facts. Get up to thinking the truth. And that's a state of worship. Transcendent of prayer.
You can do that with the adjutants because it's the seventh adjutant that's the philosophic impulse. And the sixth is just on its way.
Right. The sixth adjutant will give you the impulse to pray. Right. The seventh adjutant is an impulse that eventually leads you to worship. Right. Yeah, it's not what you would think from our historical understanding. You'd think that the spirit of worship would lead you to... It's like, no, it's not worship. It's the spirit of worship. You know, it's not religious consciousness. It's a religious impulse. Right? It primes the pump. Gives you the potential to go upward, but that impulse won't actually go upward. The only way it can go upward is through the seventh adjutant, through the philosophic impulse. If without the seventh adjutant, that religious impulse will go sideways. Right? And it has no way in and of itself to actually take you upward, but it's the energy, that allows you to potentially go upward. You know, you can't go through the neck of the hourglass if something doesn't pound you below the neck of the hourglass, okay? You get this impulse below the neck, but unless you're oriented into the neck through the philosophic impulse, you won't actually go up.
It's about self, then.
You'll go horizontally.
Current religion is becoming more and more focused on social issues, which is going sideways.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to figure out, what should they be doing? I mean, they're in an evolutionary state.
They should be seeking first the kingdom of heaven, not the kingdom of man.
That's within.
Seek first the kingdom of heaven, which is within. Why on earth are they focused on the outer life? First. Seek first the kingdom of heaven. And then the outer life things that you can imagine would be helpful will happen automatically. And they will happen truthfully, potentially. I mean, there's no hope for your actions in the external world to be of actual help to the world if they're predicated on a self-centered universe, that is the source of this outward action, right? You've got to get conformal to the cosmos, and then your action with others will be helpful if they're in the context of the whole. But if you think it's just about you, the transcendent part, manipulating the other parts into light and life, as if you were the whole, right? No, all your actions are going to produce the opposite results. You're going to get more disruption of unity. So you're imposing your individuality on it, believing that you are unity, and you're just going to disrupt it. There's going to be more and more evil in the world the more you act. No matter how much you imagine that you're going to be the source of unity, right? That's the problem. I mean, that's why we have an evil-dominated world. Because you got all these individuals that think they're the source of what the world needs.
So an example.
Instead of the cosmos.
You answered it, you know, in somewhat of a quasi-abstract terms.
So, but so did Jesus. Seek first the kingdom of heaven, you know? What did he mean by that?
Exactly.
Yeah. Right?
What's an example?
I mean, what he means by that is, you know, the kingdom of heaven is the upper domain of the hourglass. Okay? Don't seek to apply your lower domain to the external world. Seek first to go up to the upper domain and get it under control. Get it conformal with the cosmos.
I can hear you say the words, but when you experience that, give me an example of what that means.
Okay, it means logical, moral, spiritual. Those are the three levels. Okay, so the foundational level of that conformity is the logical level. Right? You have to get a logical worldview established. Right? It can't be this any of these fairy tale worlds that religionists are trying to live. You know, it has to be predicated on fact, not figment, and that. That factual world has to be understood to be causal. You're not trying to be the agent of the magic man. Right? An awful lot of people are earnestly going out there to better the world, believing they're a child of God, but the word God to them means magic man. They think they're the child of the magic man. And so they're going to be the instrument of his magic. Right? I don't have to work on getting myself into any conformal, you know, nature with some abstract cosmos. I mean, the magic man just needs to be able to flow through me, and he's not subject to any causality or logical constraints at all. He can do anything. He can make square circles. Okay? I mean, see, again, people are seeing themselves as the agent of an illogical God. I mean, should we be surprised if their actions in the world don't lead to the betterment of the world? Right? So you got to start by being grounded, logical. You know, I mean, how do you get grounded? You know, humble. And again, what are these favorable conditions? Loyal, humble, sincere, just, and patient. Right? Again, how do you seek first the kingdom of heaven? There's five favorable conditions that will naturally get you into the kingdom of heaven.
The mercy was
loyal, humble, sincere, just, and patient. You notice the just one there. You know, we were just reading about how delinquency is rarely observed. Right? Law abidingness is universal, basically. Justness is inherent in all the individuals. All the individuals are just. All the individuals are patient. All the individuals are loyal, right? Humble, sincere. They're all grounded. You know, those. You have to recognize that step one is being a valid tadpole, right? And the loyal one is directly tied to the tadpole, right? In the book, right? I mean, you want to be better for the world. Well, first you have to be a means for betterment to manifest. Something that's not loyal, humble, sincere, just, and patient cannot benefit the world. It can't. Doesn't matter how much you want it to, it can't. Right? Because, you know, even, you know, if by grace you have a connection to the cosmos and you're thinking it's just going to naturally flow down through, it's got to flow through something that's not loyal, not humble, not sincere, not just, and not patient. So the perfect harmony of the cosmos goes through that filter and comes out as what?
Distortion.
Garbage. Right. It's like, well, no, it can go around that. No, it can't. The only way it has to get to anyone else is through your mind. If your mind is confused and nonconformal, no goodness can manifest.
Right? Those conditions.
Yeah.
Fruits of the Spirit another way to look at that as well?
Yeah, right. I mean, but see, those are just such a huge step. I mean, the cosmic fruits of the Spirit. You know, tomorrow, you know, I'm going to have enduring peace. No, you're not going to have enduring peace tomorrow. You'll have enduring peace maybe on the fifth Magian World. So, you know, instead of trying to jump all the way to the end.
You know, what religion seems to be doing today is, you know, putting their effort into the outer world.
Yes, they should. Religion should be encouraging them to seek this inner integrity. A true religionist is loyal. A true religionist is humble. A true religionist is sincere, right, et cetera, just, patient. That's a true religionist. Be first a genuine religionist, and then you'll be amazed at what naturally happens when you ladle soup.
Keyword.
Okay?
Not mandated.
Don't start with the outer life. Seek first the kingdom of heaven, conformity with the cosmos. Seek first conformity with the cosmos, and then all of the things of the outer life will naturally, you'll naturally bear the fruits of the Spirit. If you're born again, what is it? It tells you in the book, you will naturally bear the fruits of the Spirit. Bear forth the fruits of the Spirit. Until you're born again, until you have conformity with the cosmos, right? If all you're conformal with is your genetics, the lower domain of the hourglass, right? No. You have to be born again. You're born into the lower domain. You have to be born again into the upper domain, which has the potential to be conformal with the cosmos.
Has nothing to do with speaking in tongues.
Right? You know, and the fact that that hourglass analogy seems to have a birth canal, the neck of the hourglass, is not a coincidence. Okay? You got to cram your gigantic egotistic self in the lower domain through that little birth canal, right? And it's not all going to fit through there. So you're going to need to strip off the garbage. Only the you know, the core of you can make it through the neck and up in there. Okay. That's what you're supposed to do. Seek first the upper domain of the hourglass. And then, you know, that'll naturally begin to come down and reform the lower domain. So that lower domain is something that can engage the external world in some helpful way. That lower domain is your associating mechanism, the way you associate the real personal you in the upper domain to the external world. Okay. Just to get back into the mode here, these schools of philosophy, right? It's all about, right, you're developing that personal living philosophy in the upper domain. And then that's going to manifest as a wonderful, beneficial philosophy of living out into the outer life, right? And produce a world that we can't even imagine. It's so cool. But it begins with, you know, upper domains that are conformal with the cosmos. And you can't limit how conformal that upper domain can be, because it has a fragment of infinity in it with an adjuster up there. It's unlimitedly conformal. It's not even limited to supremacy. As you'll see, they'll get to that. There's no limits on how conformal that upper domain can be. I mean, obviously there's a limit to how much you can manifest out into the finite domain. But, right, if you have something that's infinitely transcendent of the finite domain in the upper domain of the hourglass, effectively, I mean, there's going to be no, you know, you're going to maximize what comes out, right? You're going to reach the acme of material development in the, right, in the outer life. Right? Okay.
The provision for competitive play, humor, and other phases of personal and group achievement are ample and appropriate. A special feature of the competitive activities on such a highly cultured world concerns the efforts of individuals and groups to excel in the sciences and philosophies of cosmology. Literature and oratory flourish, and language is so improved as to be symbolic of concepts as well as to be expressive of ideas. Life is refreshingly simple. Man has at last coordinated a high state of mechanical development with an inspiring intellectual attainment, and is overshadowed both with an exquisite spiritual achievement. The pursuit of happiness is an experience of joy and satisfaction.
Again, so you think about that industry up there. See, think about what kind of industry you're talking about. Like, you know, like they're saying here with this, at last coordinated a high state of mechanical development with an inspiring intellectual attainment, et cetera. And the fact that the key competition is in the sciences and philosophies of cosmology. Right? And we mean genuine, you know, metaphysical cosmology, not what's foolishly called philosophy today. So, you know, again, it's just, you know, it's in this, you have this philosophic culture, and everything else is just details within that context. Sublime worship is a natural consequence, like we were just saying before, of that philosophic culture. All right, you know, and all these bit about, you know, ample and appropriate. Well, how do you define appropriate? See, again, it's that big picture. We'll give you this whole sense of how much of this part do you need, and what flavor of that part, and how should these two parts interact in this culture? All those details will all be understood.
Yes. Yeah. What we can even see is, no matter who wins these contests, these competitive activities, they all benefit.
Yeah.
Right. Everyone benefits.
Because none of that competition is selfishly motivated. It's holistically motivated. Right. So, you know, every sort of transcendent achievement of self automatically redounds to the whole civilization. Yeah. And then that, you know, that last line, the pursuit of happiness. Remember how, you know, I've tried to stress this, you know, what the revelators mean by happiness, you know, what that word is supposed to mean. Happiness is not natural. Happiness is artificial. It results from choice. Only a person can be happy. And notice what they're saying here. Now, the pursuit of happiness is sort of, you know, on a sin-stricken, evil-dominated, self-seeking, isolated world. Okay, that environment that you're not going to be naturally conformal to, all right, is a very negative environment in general. So you're having to stand apart from that. It's like, no, I will not, you know, be that negative phenomenon and just be a helpless victim of its causation upon me. I'm going to stand apart. Well, once the environment, you know, is free from all that horrendous nature, it's still the case that you can't actually have happiness unless you choose it. It's still artificial. You know, ultimately, there's nothing natural about your absolute unique personality, right? It's absolutely unique, absolutely not pre-existent in the environment, right? It's nothing but artificial, right? But you see how they're pointing out in all of this free will exercise of imposing this pattern upon your mind or self, your personality, it's in an environment that is in general positive. So, you know, there's the experience of joy and satisfaction coming in from the environment. You know, right now, to achieve happiness, it's in the midst in general of an environment that is not producing joy in our mind, right? Joy happens, you know, it happens naturally, right? When there's a positive environment, you know, you have this positive experience of joy. You know, but right now it's hard to have that, right? I mean, most likely your mind is in a natural state of sorrow, and you're carving out a little domain of happiness in the midst of that sorrow that the environment is imposing upon your mind.
You can master.
Okay, but not on these worlds, right? Now you carve out this little bubble of personal artifice, you know, this artificial construct, the art of your personality in the midst of a natural environment that's joy. Right? Because the environment is, you know, is producing that stimulus response in your mind. All right, so it's different. And we remember they talk about that. That, you know, that there's a downside to that, right? When the environment gets to be so positive, you know, you're going to have to spend some time in some other environments to pick up some differentials that you can't pick up on those worlds. Remember how they pointed that out earlier in the paper, how you'll have to spend some time on some worlds that are still in, you know, beginning stages so that you can get a little bit more differential happening between you and the environment. But still, regardless of the environment, no matter how positive it is, happiness is still possible because happiness is still this choice of artificialness for your mind to be not just what happens naturally, but to be an expression of the absolute artificiality of your absolutely unique personality. Yeah.
Life is refreshingly simple.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think about that.
Yeah.
That kind of an advanced world.
Everything.
It seemed like it would be simple to me. But.
Yeah, remember how they said idleness and friction? They threw in friction, right? The simplicity is all the friction has been taken out of the system. It's all light and no heat, you know, in the way the system works. No gears are grinding. Everything just runs as smooth as silk, you know? There's never any glitches, you know, it all just flows so smoothly, right? And so that makes everything so simple, you know. It's like, oh, okay, drop everything, you got it, you know. Right? Nothing like that. It's everything is,
Well, this brings up the topic of Agendanters and what it means to be an Agendanter.
Yeah.
So even on our world, is there a time that,
eventually we're going to grow out of Agendanter potential.
Okay.
Yeah. This world is only Agendanter potential for a span of time. Eventually, when we grow out of that, right? You know, you're not doing these things in the absence of a visible planetary government and, you know, all this stuff anymore. Yeah. Yeah. See, so, you know, think about that. If you're kind of relishing the challenge of being an Agendanter, well, do you want Mach Event to actually set up the planetary headquarters and get things back to normal? I mean, he's short-circuiting that potential when he does that.
Well, from the view of the whole.
Yeah. Okay. So it's give and take. See, that's why his decision is complicated,
yeah.
Right? He's got to decide when, you know, for him, when it's appropriate for him to come and not short-circuit some things, you know, that are in play right now. Yeah. Okay. So let's see a little bit more about the environment, and notice the next section, a little bit more about the individual mortals.
Section 6, the individual mortal. As worlds advance in the settled status of light and life, society becomes increasingly peaceful. The individual, while no less independent and devoted to his family, has become more altruistic and fraternal.
I think that, yeah, pretty much stands alone. Again, you could just, you know, it's just, there's such a natural collective phenomenon in play. See, they're just pointing out that there's so much more unity naturally as part of the system that you are spread out into the collective naturally, you know, altruistic and fraternal. And it's just sort of innately there as opposed to, you know, you're basically just this individual phenomenon, you know, and you have to really do something kind of non-typical to go beyond that, right, in this life right now. Altruism and fraternity are just sort of a natural part of the system there. Yep.
On your Urantia, and as you are, you can have little appreciation of the advanced status and progressive nature of the enlightened races of these perfected worlds. These people are the flowering of the evolutionary races. But such beings are still mortal. They continue to breathe, eat, sleep, and drink. This great evolution is not heaven, but it is a sublime foreshadowing of the divine worlds of the paradise ascent.
Yeah, so, and we were kind of getting to that a little before. I mean, even though we're about to read, Adjutant Mind can be taken to heights that are just completely almost unimaginable. Adjutant Mind is still not Maranja Mind.
Right. They didn't say poop, though, too, so maybe
no, they didn't have to.
Yes. They were hoping that we were at least high school and not junior high.
Right. We have to give you something you already know.
They are available. You know, again, this, you know, little appreciation, you know, and then they repeat it again, of these perfected worlds. Right? So, you know, even though, you know, the grand universal, you know, this world is existing in a grand universe that is still evolving, you know, it, in many ways, you know, especially the basic physical and things immediately tied to the physical, it has gotten to finished states. And there really isn't any more that you can really fundamentally do in some areas. You know, it is perfected. And that's what they're about to remind you of. More and more, you have a finished foundation, but you never have a finished structure that you can build upon that. They're just about to give you a neat little thing about that. So there's, you know, the perfectingness keeps moving up in the hierarchy, you know, as you get the lower levels of it, you know, all the way finished.
Do you think non-breather worlds go through this too?
Yep, non-breather worlds will go through, all, every world goes through this, yep. Yeah. You know, remember, even the architectural worlds are going through this. Right. I mean, you know, even some of the basic physical things. Remember, they talk about how, you know, not too long ago, things were very different here. You know, now this has been totally reworked physically. You know, and so I mean,
missing sections, like,
miles
long. Right?
Right. There's yeah. So, you know, there's a limit to how far even the architectural worlds can go. When there's still worlds in that system that are in rudimentary stages, yeah. Okay, so let's see. Anything else? Let's see here. Make sure we get off on these tracks, and then I make sure I haven't forgotten something that I wanted to mention.
Sublime foreshadowing is fun.
Yeah, sublime foreshadowing is fun poetry. Okay, yeah, I think we can keep going here. Yep. Yeah.
On a normal world, the biologic fitness of the mortal race was long since brought up to a high level during the post-Adamic epochs, and now from age to age throughout the settled eras, the physical evolution of man continues. Both vision and hearing are extended. By now, the population has become stationary in numbers. Reproduction is regulated in accordance with planetary requirements and innate hereditary endowments. The mortals on a planet during this age are divided into from 5 to 10 groups, and the lower groups are permitted to reproduce only half as many children as the higher. The continued improvement of such a magnificent race throughout the era of light and life is largely a matter of the selective reproduction of those racial strains which exhibit superior qualities of a social, philosophic, cosmic, and spiritual nature.
Okay, so see some details they haven't given us before. So like I was saying, this basic biologic foundation, so, you know, starting post-Adamic, like they mentioned, you start working on that. You work through the basics in those early times. You know, eventually you've got all of the violet race, you know, blended into the evolutionary stock, and all the races blended into one race, And you then get going with genetic engineering, and you do all that. See, so they're pointing out, okay, eventually you're going to get done with all that sort of very overt stuff. But there's still things you can do, even when you've gotten rid of all the degeneracy. Like, you know, the last bits of degeneracy are gotten rid of by direct genetic engineering and stuff. So finally you've got it all on the apex plane, but there's still that horizontal spectrum, right? And so, like, they're talking about this, you know, you have 5 to 10 groups, and they're still working on that apex biologic plane, but now they're not really doing genetic engineering or anything really overt, like, you know, biologic uplift, you know, mating with it, you know, material sons and daughters, children, that sort of stuff. What are they doing? See, all of this is largely a matter of selective reproduction, and it's just selective breeding. Okay, so that they're still doing that. And they're still doing that, only now it's you know, it's all in terms of the horizontal, and what they're working with there is what is predicated on that biologic foundation. So you've really got all the basics of the biology done. There's nothing else left to do there. It's perfected. But there's subtleties of how mind seats on that and how spirit engages mind. See, like they're saying, social, philosophic, cosmic, and spiritual nature, all the things that are on that biologic foundation can still be modified by selective breeding.
Think that's how the vision and hearing are done, by selective breeding?
Initially, it's all done in a very overt way, you know, like I was just talking about, a very direct way. But all those, like you're saying, there's subtleties that come into play, because again, like we were talking about way up front. Remember, as I'm looking at you right now, I'm seeing you in my mind. You know, my eyeballs are not seeing you. My mind is seeing you. And as you begin to really work on some of these high subtleties of mind potential and spiritual potential, right, your mind can begin to have representations in it that it currently is incapable of having those forms.
Real representations.
Right, you know, the representations of prior things can become much more precise. But you can also represent things in that mind that couldn't be represented at all before.
So it's not mechanical, like different glasses or things like that.
Yeah, see, all that basic stuff was already done, but now you're improving just how well a mind can represent something, independent of how complete or perfected the inputs are, right? But just fundamentally what the mind can represent. You know, that's the thing about Marantia mind. It can directly represent harmony in a way that Agitant mind can't. It has some, just, you know, the laws of it are different. It can take forms that Agitant mind can't take. Okay? It's a different representation system, a higher representation system. Okay, see, so they're beginning to work on these much higher, subtler issues, you know, which in literal terms are completely clueless about. You know, we don't, you know, even when they say social, I mean, this is so transcendent of anything we can even imagine the word social meaning, right? All the things we can imagine improving the social expression is way in the rearview mirror. They're doing all kinds of incredible, subtle things in that regard. Okay, so, and it's just fun that they actually give you 5 to 10 groups. Yeah. That little detail. You're going, well, why is it 5 to 10? I can't answer that right now, but they toss that in there just for the fun of it. Let's see, anything else there?
They're actually talking about regulation being imposed still. Because it's not,
Right, it's still imposed, but everyone's completely accepting of that imposition, right? Because everyone recognizes the physics of it.
They comply in accordance.
Right.
They're not doing it disgruntledly.
Right. That's what I think. Everyone is fully on board with the fact that they're only going to have half the number of children as some other couple, and they know exactly why, and they know it would be totally inappropriate for them to have more children because that would upset the system.
Because Mao Zedong thought so.
Right, it's not because of what Mao Zedong said, yeah.
But to get there, we have to figure out a way to impose this somehow,
some way.
It can't be done without.
Right. I mean, initially, like the Relligers point out, I mean, the early stages of civilization, wisdom has to be very aggressively, if not literally physically, imposed upon people. Right. You have some wisdom embodied in some leaders, and wisdom. I mean, the people that they're leading cannot hold wisdom in their minds. They literally don't have the capacity. So you impose it, by force a lot of times on the system. The more you go forward, the less you have to, forcibly impose, more and more the individuals recognize the wisdom of this and impose it upon themselves. But there's still people whose job it is to really be thinking about that issue, right? And keeping track of all the details and informing everyone of what's best in the system right now, right? And publishing that, and then everyone conforms with that, right? There's scientists, that are specializing in that issue. Other people are off doing other things, Not everyone is a specialist in everything. You still definitely have specialization.
Yeah. I'm curious, it must be immense value still to go through on a mortal world that's really advanced what you could graduate from a world and go right into Marantia and have pretty innately, as with Marantia Mind pointing out, even from these guys to Marantia is a huge leap.
Yeah.
But it must still be of immense value to progress that far with nothing but adjutant.
Yeah. Right. And that's just, you're on these worlds, you're obviously fleshing out the part of supremacy that can only be done with adjutant mind being used at very high levels. Right? And Marantia mind can't do it all. See, so it's all, and when you think about it, well, which is higher and which is lower? See, I mean, it's all depends upon what you're talking about. Right? Yep. It's just different. When all is said and done, it's just
you can't really assign
it's
much
just different.
Higher, lower.
For us, it's very much lower, higher.
Yeah.
But we're about to see uses of adjutant mind that are mind-boggling.
Yeah.
And just again, remember, let's say it's broken up into 10 groups. The most minimal of those 10 groups, there's no one on this planet that's even remotely qualified to be in that lowest group, right?
It's a long way.
It's in thinking about this, it's like, well, we need to form a group just for you. It's called this hermetically sealed bottle here.
Right.
You're going to be in that group, right? That's what would happen if you went to one of these worlds.
Right.
All right. Let's keep going here.
The adjusters continue to come as in former evolutionary eras. And as the epochs pass, these mortals are increasingly able to commune with the indwelling father fragment. During the embryonic and pre-spiritual stages of development, the adjutant mind spirits are still functioning. The Holy Spirit and the ministry of angels are even more effective as the successive epochs of settled life are experienced. In the fourth stage of light and life, the advanced mortals seem to experience considerable conscious contact with the spirit presence of the master spirit of superuniverse jurisdiction. While the philosophy of such a world is focused upon the attempt to comprehend the new revelations of God the Supreme, More than half of the human inhabitants on planets of this advanced status experience translation to the Morancha state from among the living. Even so, old things are passing away. Behold, all things are becoming new.
Yeah, just that last one, you know, the Bible quote. I mean, you obviously, you know, they're talking about the individual moral hero. So obviously you have the sense of that old things are passing away passage relative to the individual, like Paul is, you know, expressing it in Corinthians. But, you know, that's not why the even so is there, really. I mean, that old use of even so. It's more in the sense of how it's used in the book of Revelation, where the old things are passing away. I mean, you've got this literal world, right, that's the new earth, right? That's why they're saying even so like that. Even so, as it says in the book of Revelations, you've got the old things passing away, and behold, all things are becoming new. The whole environment is the new earth, you know, that of that vision. You've got a lot of first circlers, so there's a lot of direct interaction with adjusters, like they mentioned there. But they're reminding you, you know, you start out with a single-celled conception, engaged by the first adjutant. I mean, all that's still in place, you know, and then the second adjutant engages, et cetera, and, you know, they're born, they're pre-spiritual, you know, it's not like the Holy Spirit is encircuited, you know, after 2 months in the womb or something. No, it's still, you know, well after birth that, you know, finally the seventh adjutant engages and they're encircuited in the Holy Spirit. That hasn't changed. You start out with just, you know, animal origin, adjutant mind nature. So there's making sure you haven't, you know, floated off from that foundation here and you're thinking about these people.
It's not implying it just goes away, though, is it? The adjutant mind?
Right. No, it's not. I mean, that's what they're trying to stress. Adjutant mind can't go away.
In the beginning stages, you know, but yeah, you don't grow out of it. In other words,
And why can't, no matter how deep they are in the seventh stage of light and life, why can't they grow out of adjutant mind? Yes, because you're corporeal, right? Only adjutant mind can seed itself on a material brain. Yeah, that doesn't change.
Right.
Eventually, right? I mean, that's why you can fuse eventually. If you get up to the point where you're using adjutant mind in a completely harmonized way, where it's equivalent to, you know, those seven facets of adjutant mind have been harmonized to the point where they're equivalent to the one facet of Morancha mind. And so you can transfer the seed of your consciousness to your soul. Right? Because only Morancha mind can, you know, it has to seed on a Morancha brain. Right? Adjutant mind seeds on a material brain. And here they brought up the fourth stage, this whole bit about the sevenfold. They brought up the one issue, you may remember when we were going through that, they didn't mention the master spirit. You'll pull out the chart here again quickly. So the psychic circles and the sevenfold. Remember when we were thinking about how as you're going up, you were getting a philosophy in a more and more sweeping wholeness that you were understanding everything in? You know, as you moved up the cosmic mothers. You know, and they mentioned the ages of days, but they didn't mention the master spirits. When we got to, remember, it's second, third, fourth stage of light and life here, when we're on this level here where the master spirits are, like they're saying there. But remember, we mentioned that you're in the creative mother agencies of the Ancients of Days. You're in that wholeness level of the collective super universe level. Okay? And, so think about that. If you're actually getting to have such a subtle relationship of representing the spirit energy in the external world in your mind, that you can actually begin to take the spirit presence of the master spirit that is right now permeating this room, you know, as a literal spirit energy, and begin to represent that in your mind, okay? In order to do that, think about what it takes. You've got, that is a spirit presence that it's a part that's super universe sized. In order to have the context in which to have a relationship with said part, right, the wholeness has got to be transcendent of the super universe, a single super universe. Right? So you can't be at the reflective mother spirit level of wholeness. You've got to be that next notch up of the collective super universe level of wholeness, a whole that's bigger than that part, a super universe sized part. Just like we're seeing on the chart there. Right? That's what you've got here. And that's what they're alluding to indirectly, like they always do here early on. When they say, so you're attempting to comprehend, you know, in terms of philosophy, philosophy of such a world is focused upon the attempt to comprehend the new revelations of God the Supreme. Yeah. When they don't say Supreme Being, when they say God the Supreme, right, they're trying to get you to think top down, right? And what are they talking about? God the Mother, right? Trying to get you up to a higher level of Cosmic Mother, a mother that's big enough to encompass a part the size of a Master Spirit's presence.
Which means it must encompass more than one Master Spirit.
Right, it's a collective super universe level. The collective mother agencies of the ancients of day. See, they're the womb, you know, of that encompasses all seven super universes. It's transcendent of any specific super universe. So that there's seven parts now in that bigger whole, right? So that's what they're getting at. Ever higher, like I was saying, you're going up ever higher levels of the mother.
What you're expressing is universal. I mean, for us to recognize a part, it has to be in the context of a greater
whole.
So even down here on this
yes.
level, for us to recognize, say a political ideology, for instance, yeah. to recognize it as the part and not the whole.
And not the whole.
You have to have a higher...
Yes, yes. You have to have a philosophy that's transcendent of that. Right, and so all those people that are drops of water down in that ocean of that ideology, they all think it's the whole. It appears to be the whole to them. Well, it ceases to be the whole when you transcend it and you recognize it's a part in that greater context. But until you have that greater context, it cannot ever be a part. It will never appear to be a part. You can tell that to a person until you're blue in the face. And you know, but as soon as they get transcendent of it, you don't have to tell them anything. It's just self-evident. It's a part. And they cease to falsely exalt it anymore. Yeah. Right? And the only way to get that is, you know, you have to develop the philosophy, the higher philosophy, the greater wholeness, in which things that weren't parts anymore now become parts. Think of achieving a philosophy in which a master spirit becomes a part and not a whole.
Still using
adjutant. Right? And you're still using adjutant mind. Okay? Okay, and that's nothing. Wait till you see what else they say. Okay, so that's what they're getting at there. You know, remember how they mentioned that, you know, when you get to the fourth stage, you have more than half that are fusing. Okay, what else do they say here?
We conceive that physical evolution will have attained its full development by the end of the fifth epoch of the Light and Life era. We observe that the upper limits of spiritual development associated with evolving human mind are determined by the adjuster fusion level of conjoint Marantia values and cosmic meanings. But concerning wisdom, while we do not really know, we conjecture that there can never be a limit to intellectual evolution in the attainment of wisdom. On a seventh stage world, wisdom can exhaust the material potentials, enter upon moda insight, and eventually even taste of absinthe grandeur.
Wow. Adjutant mind.
Yeah.
Absinthe grandeur. Okay. Okay. So, how lowly is it? Okay, but now there's a very important thing that he just reminded you there. Even with the fullness of adjusters and everything, right? When all is said and done, you still have material and spiritual side by side on the plane. And they max out. But the super additive consequence of the relationship between the two cannot max out. Wisdom, philosophy, is not limited like science and religion. Philosophy is not limitable because it's a super additive consequence. Right? And it's and you can ever go more and more above, more and more super. That's what they're telling you very directly. See how they set it up. They put the two on the plane side by side and say, yeah, you can get some really cool things side by side, but then you're out of juice there, just in and of themselves. But you can never run out of the super additive consequence. Not even finiteness, you know, will limit you. You can begin to transcend finiteness, begin to bring in, you know, an insight of absonity, right, into that mind. Right. Okay, so again, it's just, you know, that's why I keep stressing this. It's important to stop, you know, thinking that religion is an end in itself. No, it's a beginning. You want to get get something that can't be ended. Wisdom, philosophy, the super additive consequence. All right.
We observe on these highly evolved and long seventh stage worlds, human beings fully learn the local universe language before they are translated. And I have visited a few very old planets where Abaddonters were teaching the older mortals the tongue of the super universe. And on these worlds, I have observed the technique whereby the Absonite personalities reveal the presence of the Finaliters in the Marantia Temple.
I told you they were going to mention a little bit about how, there's still some things that you need a lot of help to visualize for you. Right, but yeah, but just look at what the, I mean. Yeah, you know, like I said, I mean, how inscrutable is this? Remember how they mentioned the Absonite personalities? Okay, now the Absonite personalities are somehow helping to visualize Finaliters for you. I mean, what on earth is the physics of this? But the clue seems to be in the previous paragraph that you've got a mind that at least, in terms of insight, sort of transcendent of direct consciousness, has some resonance with an Absonite personality. And they're actually somehow helping to sort of get this into your mind. Oh my goodness.
Well, something has been lost on me is the fact that Finaliters have a form.
Yeah. Yeah, don't forget, they're not
completely been lost on me. I just think of them as a pinpoint.
No, they have. Yeah. You can draw a box, and they're all totally inside the box. And they're also not zero volume. And then remember the Abaddonters, just quickly. We don't have to go back to it, but if you want to go back and remind yourself of the specifics, where they're sort of officially introduced is right at towards the end of paper 37, the last paragraph of section 9 in that paper. That's where it tells you who they're the offspring of. It says that the creation of the unrevealed agents of the Ancients of Days and the seven reflective spirits resident on the capital of Orvinton. Okay, in other words, those two mothers, right? The mother we were just talking about, the creative mother agencies of the Ancients of Days, and then the reflective mother spirits, those two together produce these Abaddonters. All right, so that mother that you were synchronizing with, right, in which the master spirit was a part, is the parent of these Abaddonters that are they're talking about, you know, in play here. Yeah. So, very transcendent, curious, mysterious stuff. Anyway, that's what's going on there. And you think about, wow, well, if I take the mother that is at the collective super universe level and I get a super additive consequence with another mother, I must be starting to really kind of push up against the ceiling of the finite, aren't I? Yeah. Right. Okay. Yeah.
They have a boundary nature that can facilitate what they're talking about.
Yeah, right. You see, right. It all makes sense as far as we can understand it. Okay, anyway.
I'm trying to figure out how can two mothers get
along. Okay. This is the story of the magnificent goal of mortal striving on the evolutionary worlds. And it all takes place even before human beings enter upon their Marantia careers. All of this splendid development and is attainable by material mortals on the inhabited worlds, the very first stage of that endless and incomprehensible career of paradise ascension and divinity attainment.
Okay, just a quick thing that they're trying to stress. Humble. Completely beyond your wildest imaginations, but it's just a step one. Okay, so how transcendent is it, this actual journey to paradise?
Oh, no. Humbling. Forget about it.
Right. I mean, these people aren't jumping to paradise when they die.
Yeah.
They're just jumping to the local universe headquarters.
Right.
And everything beyond that is completely transcendent of this stuff.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, so... you know, and all of it is negligible in comparison to what you do on the second and first circles of Avona, right? You can sum up everything to get to the point of personal recognition of the Father on the third circuit. All of that is effectively zero achievement relative to what you have to achieve on the inner two circles of Avona. I mean, it's just so transcendent to get to paradise, right? Okay. They're trying to get you to, you know, humbly put yourself in the context here.
Very, very humbly.
Okay.
But can you possibly imagine what sort of evolutionary mortals are now coming up from worlds long existing in the seventh epoch of settled light and life?
No.
It is.
Next sentence.
It is such as these who go on to the Marantia worlds of the local universe capital to begin their ascension careers.
Yeah, keep going.
If the mortals of distraught Urantia could only view one of these more advanced worlds, long settled in light and life, they would never more question the wisdom of the evolutionary scheme of creation. Were there no future of eternal creature progression, still, the superb evolutionary attainments of the mortal races on such settled worlds of perfected achievement would amply justify man's creation on the worlds of time and space. We often ponder, if the grand universe should be settled in light and life, would the ascending, exquisite mortals still be destined to the core of the finality? But we do not know.
Okay. So just appreciate it, you know. Oh, I'm imagining myself getting to paradise. No, you're imagining yourself getting off of one of these worlds at best, right? I mean, like I was saying, if you were to see this, there isn't anything you can imagine that could be the point of reality besides what you observe actualized there. Like, well, okay, if you've got this actualized, there's nothing else you could possibly actualize. No, there's infinitely, you know, stuff infinitely transcendent of that.
Literally.
Right? Literally. All right, so just blow all these ceilings out of your mind, right? Set yourself free from all these preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices about the future, right? And put one giant infinite question mark in front of your eyes and journey towards it, right?
Why wouldn't they be? Yeah. You know, if the grand universe should be somewhat, still be destined to the core of finality, and wonder, so it's interesting. Now you got me thinking. Why wouldn't they be?
There's probably mortals that are so sublime that they can visualize these guys with the help of these Abbot doctors.
Yeah. Right, but as he just finished saying, they still have spirit beings in you, and they're still, you know, they haven't even gotten out of this.
Right, they still can't skip over the Marantia yet.
They're basically suggesting that, okay, well, now that you've hit that point in
everybody's
evolution,
like life, right?
As an adjutant mortal, you really don't need to concern yourself with the finality or destiny or flirting with that.
But they're just, you know, they're just reminding you of, you know, even when you kind of fully understand the whole physics of becoming finaliters and how they fit in and everything, you know, none of the revelators know what happens, you know, when the grand universe is settled in light and life. I mean, all the physics changes, right? Everything changes, and no one knows what becomes of all these well-understood techniques, you know, and goals and achievements and everything, so.
This is presented by a mighty messenger. Isn't that a Trinitized being?
Right, I mean, he's gone all the way up to finality and got snatched out by the Paradise Trinity, and
so his vision is limited, and that's part of what keeps him going.
Yeah, and that's even being given that sort of fiat completeness by the Paradise Trinity, and still, right. Because again, I mean, the things that genuinely are transcendent, not insight, but sightfully, of the finite are unknown, right? Even to the highest finite being. Right? Now, the master architects understand all that stuff, but but even though a master, you know, the architects inducted you into the core, right? Just because you're in the core of the finality, you know, even you don't, you know, transcend the grand universe yet. So anyway, just all those again, remember, when we're talking about master architects or even these unrevealed absonite personalities, right, these are absonite personalities, so, I mean, you know, the big question is, what do they see? Right, see, you know, for them, the outer space levels aren't the future.
Right.
Yeah.
They would tell us if they could.
Yeah.
We have no capacity.
That's the real mystery. You know, see, it's shades of the mystery of mysteries, right? I mean, right, for an adjuster, you know, they exist in the cosmos infinite as a fact, not a future.
Right.
And absonite beings exist in a master universe. You know, at least some measure of the master universe. It might not be the whole thing, right? Because there's levels of, right, of absonite. But some measure, you know, is a fact, not a future. It's a present. It's all very confusing. Again, it reminds you that time is not an absolute, right? And it's not a reality. It's just an appearance. Okay. All right, we've gone way over here again. So, okay, so it just appears that we've gone way over. It's true, we haven't really. Okay, so next time you see, we'll get into, like I said, we'll get into the bigger, you know, sort of the macroscopic rather than the microscopic stages of light and life, and start all again, step through all of that, and they'll start out by giving us a few little juicy morsels about the planetary thing that they haven't given us already. All right, let's take a moment, everyone.